Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Changing Times, the Alan Wood Conversations.
Proudly supported by Kildare County Council.
On my way back from Baltimore, as soon as I got into LAX, I had a message saying that I was fired. No reason, just fired. That's it. And I had a concert 8 days later. So my first thing is the audience is coming. They expect me to be there.
So here we are again, Mary, and this time we are having a lovely conversation about music and human stories and video games. How are you on video games?
I'm not good on video games. No, I have to say, I mean, if my grandsons were here, Emer is a legend in the video games industry, as we know, which pretty much covers my two grandsons, but not their granny. On the other hand, there's a lawyer in me somewhere, and she's also a legend in relation to the law, because this woman made legal history, you know, defending the rights of women, defending the rights of women in music and in pregnancy who were treated badly. That took one heck of a lot of courage.
It's actually quite difficult, Emer, to do you justice in an introduction, because you've got such an incredible list of achievements. You're Ireland's queen of games music, one of the world's premier composers of game scores, 28 film and video game titles, and they've had lots of industry accolades, including, Mary, the Hollywood Music and Media Award. And you conduct orchestras all over the world. And then
also the
Academy Awards.
We all remember that.
In 2020, when you were the first female conductor. So, Emer Noon, you're so very welcome. We're delighted to have you here and to talk about all of these things. And, of course, the legal aspect of your career as well with the court case. But can we go right back? Because, you know, OK, Los Angeles, the Academy Awards, stages all around the world. But you grew up in Kilconnell in East Galway. Will you just give us a little bit of a picture of what that was like?
Well, I think I just had a very normal, very Irish, very normal Irish upbringing. You know, I don't think there was anything unusual that anyone can point to and go, well, I couldn't have done that, or I couldn't have, because we had such a different upbringing. What I love about it is it was so normal and so Irish. But I have to say as well, your introduction, all I can hear in my head is, oh my God, look at who's sitting in front of you, because it's mortifying for me to hear you read that list. I'm thinking it's Mary Kennedy and our former Uachtaráin, you know, who, and I joke.
Have you any idea how we felt sitting watching the Oscars?
Yes.
And the first female steps up on the podium to conduct, and it's an Irish woman.
She's from Galway.
Oh my Lord. I mean, it was
so proud.
It was one of those spine tingling moments when you realise, you know what? See, our education system, it is somewhere between brilliant and fantastic. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we all have our angels, and a lot of the angels are, you know, the regular people in our community, especially our teachers. And what happened with me is we were all handed a tin whistle one day in class in St. Gabriel's National School. And I thought this was brilliant. This thing responded to everything I wanted it to do. And it wasn't, you know, it just, it magically happened. And so I went away for the weekend with this new instrument. And my mum and dad were building a house. Had just moved down from Dublin to their, where they grew up in East Galway originally. And I had this tin whistle, came back playing tunes that I'd heard on the telly.
Over a weekend, you came over back a weekend. Playing tunes.
Yeah, and one of them was
That's a sign.
The theme from Glenroe. So, and Margaret Blaheen was the teacher, Mrs. Blaheen. And she came and insisted to mum and dad, came up to the house, which, you know, even when I was a kid, having the national school teacher who was very, you know, our school teachers were very classically educated themselves, absolutely fantastic. But the teacher was that higher up in society that descended upon the house and insisted that my parents buy a piano. And they were trying
to... There was no
piano
in the house.
There was no piano in the house. They were trying to buy furniture for the new build.
Yes.
My brother was 3 years younger, so I would have been about five and he was about two, you know. And so it was a big, huge expense. And in that part of the country, you know, at that time, very few houses had a piano in them. So what I did was I practiced at lunchtime at school, and that started a tradition for me of practicing at lunchtime at school, whichever school I was in.
And did you love it from the beginning, Emer?
I did, yeah, I did. And I remember that teacher, Margaret Blaheen, she said, well, listen, my daughter Maeve will teach you for a little while. So I'd go into her. She had one of those big Georgian houses with a big long driveway, terrified up to, and she was so kind, you know, there's no reason to be terrified, but coming in, and I remember the picture frames rattling on her baby grand piano in the drawing room, and Maeve teaching me a few chords and things. I joke as well that when the football was kicked out of the schoolyard, was the local composer that kicked it back, you know, Paddy Fahey, whose house is across the road from the school and is to this day. We lost Paddy a couple of years ago at the ripe young age of 102. And it was just the thing of, you know, we've talked a lot about in the last 10, 15 years about if you can see it, you can be it. But it wasn't that I wanted to be like Paddy, who was adored when I was a student. I got to know him much more. He's a wonderful man. But it was that it was just a normal thing. You could be a teacher, a farmer, a banker, a nurse, a doctor, a composer. And this is the other thing I talk about when I'm asked is the performing opportunities we had all the time for doing mass.
Yes,
you know,
that's true.
All
stage.
The time.
In the middle of the village.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. There was constant, we were always rehearsing for some mass or other. And this was the big mass was the opening of the school. And I remember I'd been playing the tin whistle and learning piano, classical piano at this point. And I remember the principal decided, Mr. Paddy Burke, who was absolutely fantastic. I mean, we were learning French and German. We were learning we used to have to get our books secondhand because the new books weren't good enough for him. He was absolutely fantastic. And he decided I was to play the flute. He decided. So then a friend of my aunt decided, well, I have a flute. I have a wooden trad flute, and Father Cahill Stanley, and he brought the box, a wooden box with the instrument, and we went to a local teacher and she said, no way, you'll never have it on time for this mass. So for me, that's a challenge. You're right. So small little things in small village in East Galway. And
how old were you then?
I was 11. So it was the Lark in the Clear Air that I played, and I nearly passed out trying to learn this and practice it, and my fingers were too small for the holes. And eventually, years later, I ended up getting a scholarship to the College of Music and was there for 8 years.
You have to have the talent.
Well, I have this thing that it takes a village to raise an idea, and you have one little kid with a mad idea, and I didn't know how mad it was because I joke there weren't enough people in the village to tell me. You know, we were only about 400 and 500 people. But people, you know, came with their bits and bobs to add to the, here's an instrument from here and this one will teach you this bit. And it's very simple, but it's community.
And good family support.
Great family support. Yeah.
Were your parents not a little bit worried about a career in music?
I used to drive my dad mad, and he was very supportive. Dad's thing was question, but show up. So, for instance, it was always, what are you going to do with the music degree? And even earlier, questioning. I remember a little show I did, I was about 11, and I used to get the lead in my little national school, but I was doing this summer school, and they gave me a really, really, you know, nothing role in this play. And I said, Dad, please don't come. I'd be very embarrassed, you know, if you saw that. This is me at 11 or 12 years of age, you know, all full of myself, you know. And I said, don't come. No, it's just, I'm just like basically standing there doing nothing, you know. And then I remember the show being behind the curtains, and I was like, gosh, I looked out at all the parents in the audience. I was like, why did I say that to him, you know? And I looked, I opened the curtains. Typical Emer would be to open the letter from the T, open the curtains and look out. And there he was in the front row with my brother. Took the day off work, you know.
Mm. So you were thrilled.
So I was absolutely delighted. And I was the best tree you've ever seen, you know.
But you had the ambition, Emer. The ambition was there.
You know what it is? It's the doing of it. Mm. It's, I get that. I get, you must be very driven. And I like, no, it's just the doing of it. I just wanted to be inside it and touching it and tasting it and feeling it and figuring out how it's working. And why does it make me feel this way? Mm. Why do I have goosebumps on my arm? I have no idea what's happening right now.
Why do I think you are not talking about this thing that people call ambition? You're talking about something completely different.
Because that's ambition can have the connotations of career, profile, money, all of that. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. However, that is not what drives me today. And that's not what ever drove me. It was just this visceral human experience that I wanted to be inside. I want to know how is this happening? What is this esoteric thing? We can't touch it. We can't see it. Why is it making me feel this way? And that's still to this day, that's exactly what drives. And Craig, my husband, is the same way. And it's funny when I'm asked, you know, around the time of the Academy Awards, there was a lot of, you must be so, I'm like, I felt like saying, yes, I've stepped on a few grannies, you're right, you know, to get here. But no, it's just not, it never entered my head. Mm-hmm. It never entered my head to ask, what does a musician get paid? Never entered my head. I would just look at professionals, as I call them with a capital P growing up, and think, what an incredible life. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to be like them.
Your passion is phenomenal.
Yeah, it is.
Your passion is phenomenal.
Oh,
and you can see it in the eyes as you're talking there. I wish the audience could see your eyes. They're just sparkling and just full of joy and glee and wonder and curiosity, just all merged into one there. What was it like when you became a student in Trinity, coming up from the small place, now home, up to Trinity? What was that like?
I found Trinity very different. I had gotten such an experience at the College of Music. I was a marvellous teacher, very, very nurturing. It was very, very quite a negative teaching method, old school classical music, very, very critical. I remember my first...
No nurturing?
No.
No support? No, I remember it was very critical. Right, some one of your teachers made a really very disparaging remark to you. And, you know, the kind of remark that if you weren't a strong character, could have just knocked the stuffing out of you.
Well, that was not a Trinity. Mm. I know what you're referring to. It wasn't.
Right. Thank God to hear that. That's good.
No, it was not. It was a conductor that I'd grown up watching on TV and thinking, oh my gosh, this is the nadir, you know, this is everything I want to be. And I met him in capacity where I was actually, they'd come to the College of Music, we need some of the older students to do some teaching. And so I was there in that sort of capacity. But he asked me on a lunch break, he said, what do you want to do with your music degree? And I quietly, and this is the thing of, just because I speak softly, don't mistake it for weakness, quietly said, well, I'd like to be a conductor and a composer. Now, little did he know that since I decided that when I was 7 years of age, you know, and I'd been practicing up in my parents' attic for years and years. He said to me, he goes, you haven't a chance. You've got three things going against you. you're young, you're Irish and you're female. And then he called over his colleague and told him, and they both had a good laugh.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Wow. So it wasn't just him saying, he called over another professional with a capital P.
Wow.
It really hurt me deeply. And this is, I think, this is something to acknowledge, is that just because something hurts you deeply and takes a while to recover from, doesn't mean you won't recover and come back stronger. And it takes the time it takes. And that's really what happened. And this was also, and this is quite a typical story where you see that person nurturing somebody else at the same time, who's not of your gender.
Right.
Okay. So you see that going on at the same time that you're being told you haven't a chance. And you're wondering, what is different between me and him? I don't understand why, because I hear the work, I see the work, and I don't understand the difference. You know, clearly all artists are different, but I mean, at that point, that student level, it was kind of a lot relied on, you know, technique and things like that. So that hurt, but I kept looking around going, hang on a second, and working on my craft and saying, if he can do it, I know at least I can do that much. I have a lot to learn. I need to improve. I need to study. I need to tool up, get all the skills. But if he's doing it, why can't I do it? Mm-hmm. This is logic.
Your story resonates so strongly with me, because when I was 15 or thereabouts and was asked by our local parish priest what I wanted to be, and I said that I would like to be a lawyer. And I still remember the pitying look that came across his face. And he said, oh, my dear, that can't possibly be. And there are two reasons, he said. One, because you are a woman. And secondly, because there's nobody belonging to you in the law.
I didn't really know that female was different until that moment.
Yes.
You know, I mean, my dad never treated me differently to my brothers. My mum never treated me differently. So I didn't, it was a shock.
So, Emer, there was a big move from Galway to Trinity. And then tell us about the shift then to Los Angeles and how you ended up there.
Oh, my gosh. So I owe so many people so many things. There was a wonderful program, composition program, the Irish Chamber Choir were running for schools. And they came as far as Finian's and Mullingar. So I was working with the Ballinasloe Musical Society as a 14 and 15 year old. And the head of music in Athlone Community College at the time said, well, we got, you know, we're invited to do this thing. Do you want to come along with us? We'll just throw you in with our crew. So I sort of did a moonlight job for my own school. But I wrote this piece for the chamber choir and I couldn't believe it. I was like, what? The Irish Chamber Choir are going to be there? You know, these are like my superheroes.
And they're going to play your music?
And they're going to sing my, what? This is just too much. I couldn't. So I stayed up all night, getting in trouble for not getting my homework done for school, writing this piece. I had no notation software, none of what they have now. I was opening up books of piano sonatas by Beethoven to try and figure out how to write for a choir. Colin Mobby was the choir director at the time. And Colin, I mean, this little moment led directly to me getting that opportunity to LA in a weird way. Colin walked over to me laughing. And he said, you clean up your handwriting and we'll perform your piece on RTE at Dublin Castle. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, what? What are you, what? So I never forget going up to Dublin Castle, hearing the Irish Chamber Choir perform the piece.
Your music.
And you then, were what age?
I think I was 15 or 16, 16 maybe.
Extraordinary story.
But that's another of those programs. And so what happened was, I get this letter in the door saying, you've been accepted on the Ennis Imro Composition Summer School. And it was a summer school run by Imro. I'd never applied. It was Colin. And here I was at 17, the youngest student by far, and being coached by composers from Denmark, from South America, from the UK. And then I got another, just after I did my Leaving Cert, I got another thing in the door that I didn't apply for. From UCLA Extension, we're doing a program in Dublin on film scoring, all going back to Colin Mobby. And they brought over a really well-known orchestrator, worked with Danny Elfman and worked with all these amazing composers. And he hired me on the class from the class on the strength of my work because...
I bet you were the only person he hired.
Yes.
Of course you were.
Colm Connolly came out to Trinity and we had no connections with anyone. It was a film director we'd met along the road. Colm Connolly out, And when we were rehearsing in Regent House over Front Square there, mm-hmm. and I used to go down to the post office around the corner from Trinity with a bag full of coins and call Los Angeles, almost inconceivable, you know, call Los Angeles, hi, do you have the music for Braveheart? I'm calling Franz Waxman, the composer's son. I don't even know where I found out that he had the music. I was performing the Batman score. This orchestrator had worked on that score. He brought me over to LA to work on some projects, and he was a very tough taskmaster. And that was quite a shock coming from college to Los Angeles. Mm. The work ethic and the level of expectation is intense. Very, very intense.
A lot of pressure.
It was a lot of pressure. It was the hours you're expected to pull, the attention to detail, you get to make one or two mistakes, but that's it. But you do get a shot. And that's all I wanted. Mm-hmm. I wanted a shot. I wasn't getting opportunities at home, even though I was creating them as much as possible. And I was seeing them going elsewhere. There were opportunities there, but they were not coming my way. And I talk about that not out of there's nothing negative attached to it, but it's for others out there who see this around them to know that, you know, it could be a culture. It might not just be, it might not be you. I think as well, when you know you have a safety net in an Irish family, that you can go out and fail and come back and get dusted off. I think Irish women are incredibly tenacious. Mm-hmm. I think that it's this, you know, I don't need to be aggressive or cruel or just let me do my thing. You know, that's I just want to make things. I just want to make the music and make the films and make the video games. It's not a huge ask. It shouldn't be political. It shouldn't be, you know, it's not brain surgery. You know, I'm not saving lives. You know, it's just entertainment. So.
Changing Times, the Alan Wood Conversations.
Proudly supported by Kildare County Council.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You stood up and you were counted on behalf of women and of stage performers when you took this case in 2013, wasn't it?
It was 2016, but it started in 2013. Yeah, it was a long process.
That was the year, though, after you lost your first son. To tell us a little bit about that, because they are connected.
They are connected. So Aaron Porrick, our first son, was born actually just the year after we lost Dad as well. So his dad died at 50, in his late 50s, after a long battle with cancer. And we were very, very close. And Aaron was to be our bright light. I was very excited, very, very normal pregnancy until it wasn't. And we lost him at 36 weeks. It was the worst nightmare. And I can't think of someone on this planet that I dislike enough to wish this upon them. Nobody, absolutely not. It was cruel, absolutely cruel. I had an amazing doctor. We were at UCLA Medical in Santa Monica. Fantastic. Dr. Doran Blumenfeld, a beautiful man, a grandfather himself, and his whole team, very international. They were so kind. They were so thoughtful. It was horrendous. And we brought him home, and he's in East Galway with my dad. And it's, you can see how it breaks couples. You can see how it breaks people. You can see why people would never want to go through that again or never want to have children again. it's a mark on your soul going forward.
It didn't do that to you and Craig, or did it, but it brought you together eventually.
Craig was Aaron's dad. Yeah, you know, that's how I saw him from then on.
Yes.
And I will never forget, this is something I don't think I've ever spoken about, but I'll never forget the funeral director in Loughrea. The job, the beautiful stanchions and the beautiful blue ribbons and his staff so beautifully dressed, and watching my brothers with those little blue ribbons in each, and my husband with the little Aaron's little box. Mm-hmm. And absolutely unbelievable. And when we went to pay him afterwards, he said, we don't take money for angels here. And this is, again, beautiful, decent people. And actually that day I had a grand mal seizure and ended up in hospital for several days because and this is another thing of angels. When that happened, there were four professional nurses in the room, in the building. My aunt saved my life that day, and I had three other family members who are nurses in
the
building.
Had you ever had such an experience before?
Never will again, according to the doctors, never have.
Thank God.
And it was just, this is too painful, I'm out. See ya, bye, you know. And my aunt Marion was there. This is a woman who's built hospitals in Bahrain and Iraq. And, you know, there was a house full of, it's one of those things, something has to happen, but a deal is done somewhere to make sure we minimize the damage somehow by having these people around and these angels around us. So I went from there back on stage 5 weeks later, back on tour. Mm-hmm. I'd been on tour for over a year at this point, played all over the world. And a friend of mine, Nikki, in Los Angeles, before I was going back on stage, and Mum came with me. The first concert back was in Montreal. And my friend Nikki calls me up and she says, I have a gift for you. And I was like, does this woman understand that there's no gift on planet Earth that could cheer me up? It's going to cheer you up. I was like, there's nothing that can cheer me up. And she comes into the house with this shoebox. And she said to me, now, when you walk out on that stage, I want you to walk out there and hold your head up high and feel like $1 million. And she opens this box of Christian Louboutin shoes.
No. With the red soles.
With the red soles.
Exactly.
No. And the high heels.
And I cried laughing. I just cried laughing. I was just like, first of all, I said, Nikki, this is so you and so Hollywood. I can't even, you know. But I cried laughing. And so what I did was, every concert thereafter, I took a picture of the shoes on the podium or in the conductor's dressing room. And it was like the Kennedy Center, it was Mann Center, it was Wolf Trap, it was all these places. Sent Nikki the picture of the shoes.
Wasn't
on
a
the
great
podium.
Distraction. Mm-hmm.
It was brilliant. She knew what she was doing, clever girl, you know, and it just was fantastic. But it was tough. They made it tough for me when I came back. Mm. And you know, we decided, you know, this can't be our story. Let's honor Aaron's memory. I mean, he's very much part of our family. My boys talk about him. They know all about him. And let's not end the story here. So I announced my pregnancy with Eliam. And I'd been back on tour for ages. We've been getting really good reviews and we'd done the Sydney Opera House and we'd done... So when I was in Sydney, actually, I found out that it wasn't just jet lag I was feeling.
Okay.
But given that the key to the Sydney Opera House is a big piece of plastic with a flashing light on it, like your dinner is ready, ma'am, you know, one of those things. And we were having an absolute blast and we found out that we were expecting Eliam. I announced the pregnancy and I got a very, you know, I got a sort of over the top answer of great, you know, we're so excited. And I didn't, that was quite unusual. It wasn't the way, you know, how someone communicates as you've been working with for a couple of years. So I was just kind of raised a little bit of a red flag, but then I brushed it off. Back on tour, finishing up around the 30-week mark, I performed with the Philadelphia Orchestra. So excited, went really, really well, loved the orchestra. 2 days later, I was with Maren Alsop's. She was with the Baltimore Symphony at the time, did that, went really well. So went from there on stage. I had asked for a stool to be made available to me, not when I was conducting, so that I could sit when the producers were doing some speaking on stage, because I'm standing with a big belly under stage lights. I already brought my own hot water bottle, which is in front of me. And I'm sweating profusely. And I came off stage and I said, please, please cut the talking. Please, those, you know, I'm you're killing me. I'm, you know, I'm fine. The conducting is, everything's fine. But if I'm standing on the podium after doing all this and you leave me there under the lights without somewhere to sit, because this is the one request I had made, that became a big thing in the case.
That should be health and safety.
Especially given your history with your previous pregnancy. A bit of compassion.
There was a great lack of that. So on my way back from Baltimore, as soon as I got into LAX, I had a message saying that I was fired.
Fired?
Absolutely, yeah.
For a reason?
No reason, just fired. That's it. And I had a concert 8 days later. So my first thing is, the audience is coming. They expect me to be there. Mm-hmm. You know, this is letting down the audience. That's who I serve. You know, I went away and I went, you know what, I can't let this happen. This is not. And I also lost a year and a half. All the dates, you don't hire a conductor this week and they start next week. You know, it's year of dates ahead, 6 months, a year, 18 months ahead. I'd lost all of my work, things that I had, you know, passed off on other things to do. All of it went away. And I said, at this point in time, and this is what I suppose I went to do this to my baby at this, after everything we've been through, to take away my livelihood, when I have served this with my whole heart. After 2 years, I've given my heart to this production completely, because that's how I give to everything I work on is the same. I just thought, if I allow this to happen to me, this will happen again. We're the ones that'll set protocol for how we're treated in the industry and in our daily working life.
And for others coming up after
you. The other ones coming behind us, absolutely. And I said to myself, I was thinking of Maddie, my stepdaughter, what would I do if this happened to Maddie? Mm. And that's what really got me. If I allow myself to be bullied, how can I stand in front and lead an orchestra? I couldn't be a participant in this happening in the future. When I have all the opportunity.
This kind of goes back to your decent upbringing in Ireland again, doesn't it? It's the way you think and are concerned for other people.
Yeah.
Responsibility for others too.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So what happened was, Craig started to research and found Equal Rights Advocates in San Francisco, run by an amazing woman called Eileen Farrell, of course.
Guess where she was from.
Now, she's Irish-American, but she's one of us to the core, you know. So they worked with a particular firm on Sunset in Los Angeles. It was like I walked into a movie at one point during this this process. The lawyers, the firm, it was amazing LA law firm, straight out of central casting, as they say, you know. One of the partners, Doug Silverstein, my lawyer, was like Charlton Heston type, you know, character with a big boomy voice, handsome and brilliantly spoken. When, I swear, every time he stood up, the jury sort of, you know, the heads sort of flopped to the side.
Oh, you couldn't lose.
Doug was amazing. He was brutal with me in terms of how he, because he cared, you know, he cared, and he wasn't going to let me be a big idiot that, you know, he'd say to me, you have terrible poker face. And I'd say, I'm a conductor and I'm Irish. Of course I have terrible poker face. We speak with our faces, you know, because it was such a landmark case. I was on the stand for 14 hours.
That's savage, really. Savage. Yeah.
Seven under cross-examination. And I have to say, the lawyer for the other side was exceptionally bright. It was very, very scary. I learned a lot about the process. I, as much as I would be against the death penalty, I'm now absolutely 100%, because I saw how a really talented lawyer can spin things.
Bend, manipulate.
Absolutely.
How did you cope with all of the stress of those 16 days?
My family. I lost, I think, a stone weight in that time. I was so stressed. I used to listen to AC/DC walking down the corridor, because then you walk down the corridor with your two lawyers either side of you, and you can see other people on the corridor wondering, what's she in for, sort of thing. It's very hard to listen to your character being assassinated, you know, in front of 12 very sweet looking people. And there's reporters from CBS down the back and things like this.
Because this is international. It's not just American national. This is an international story.
Well, it really is case law in the state of California.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So any project of this stage project that originates there will be protected under this case law for female, for pregnant performers, actors, comedians, you know. I remember sitting there waiting for the jury to come back, and they walk out and they can't look at you. They can't show anything. They can't, you know.
You can't read them like you could an audience, I guess, or an orchestra.
Right. And they the judicial assistant reads out they show it to the judge first, and then they hand it over and they call out the question form, yes or no. And when I heard the first yes, I just burst into tears. And then you think you've won. Then they poll the jury. And then they ask them, they make each one of them stand up and say what their answer was. Then they decided that one of the jurors had, there was something on his answer page that was a mistake. So they sent the entire jury back, because they were hoping, we needed 10 out of 12. They were hoping they could get one to change, because they had somehow, I don't know how they knew, there was one guy who was on the fence because he was going with people of his culture that were the two no's, and he didn't know he'd have to state his answer in front of me. So when they went back, their other side was hoping, now we'll get our one person that we need. When they came back, it was the opposite. I had one more.
Wow.
It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible.
Mm.
And I got to meet some of the jurors afterwards, and they actually added a charge. They were so horrified by how I was treated, they added the charge of fraud, malice and oppression.
Oh, malice.
And I came out saying, I never want to see the inside of a courthouse ever again. It was the opposite. And I didn't talk about it until recently because of that litigious, the fear of being seen as litigious.
It brought about change in the law in the state of California. Did it change you?
Yes, I have to say.
In what way?
I thought to myself, and this is what, you know, a friend of mine in college, actually, from the North, used to always say, just keep yourself right. No matter what, keep yourself right. And I thought, no matter what happens in the career, if I can look at myself in the mirror and be okay with that person, we can build, we can come back, we can do things. I'm somebody that I'm fascinated that I can have nothing and walk into a library and be the richest person on earth. And that's why I'm so passionate about education and the arts. But I need to keep myself right. And I felt like not only had this worked out, but I felt welcomed by the city of Los Angeles and these 13 ordinary Los Angelinos who had stood up for me, you know, who had stood up for me, an immigrant. And I felt like, this is my city, you know, Galway is my county and this is my city. And that was really eye-opening. And there were so many cultures involved in that, you know. And it was very, between that and being looked after when we lost Aaron, I mean, that really opened my eyes to how much we're responsible to each other on the, you know, on the world stage. And yeah, it changed me in that I went, this is the hardest thing, besides putting my father and son in the ground. This is the next hardest thing I've ever done. And I never want to do it again.
that loyalty to the people of Los Angeles, is that some of the thinking behind the fact that you divide your time between Galway and Los Angeles?
Yes.
To this day?
Yeah, we made the change during COVID. And I absolutely admire, and these are some of the hardest working people on the planet, and there's so much kindness in that city. All the fake stuff gets the most publicity, but there's so many, especially the musical community, that supported me in my career. I mean, when we did the Academy Awards, I'd worked with most of the orchestra already over the career, and I'd been given opportunities.
Emer, we can't finish without asking you about the Academy Awards. You were the first female conductor of the orchestra in 2020, am I right?
That's right.
What was that like? How did it come about?
Oh my gosh. First of all, it was completely joyful from beginning to end. But how it came about, it's one of those things where you're slogging away for 20 years and you get 2 minutes in front of the Oscars audience and all of a sudden, you know, where did she come from? I just slogged away for, you know, blinkers on, head down, from one gig to the next thing, to the next thing, to the next thing. I always say that I had no contacts because I want people who want to do things to understand that you don't have to be on the inside, or, you know, that just you just follow the intensity of your passion, you know. So what happened was I had done a little bit of work with the music director for the Academy Awards, Ricky Miner, who's just the most beautiful human being. He's wonderful. He's the music director for the Grammys, and he used to be Whitney Houston's music director. So I'd done a little bit of work, and I was on this impossible, impossible tour, wonderful people, but it was the Maria Callas hologram tour. And it was incredibly difficult to put together. So I'd shown Ricky this mad thing that Craig and I had created to synchronize a live orchestra playing opera and recitative and all of this stuff. With a hologram with using Maria Callas's original vocal recordings, which were very rubato. They moved and they just beautiful, but to represent her interpretation was a nightmare. And we somehow pulled it off. So I was showing Ricky this. And he's like, oh, my God, this is horrendous. How are you doing this? This was so difficult. But when it came then to the Academy Awards, I was home in Ireland. We came home. We were in the Woolsey fires in Malibu and was just, we wanted a break. So we decided we were working on a film by Mo Honan, brilliant Irish producer. So we came home to do her film. And I was, you know, Craig found, checked my email. I said, would you ever check my email? I haven't looked at it in a while. He goes, oh, Ricky Miner wants to know your availability in February from this day to this day. Bet you he wants you to conduct the Oscars. I said, Craig, how on earth do you get from what's your availability to conducting at the Oscars? What is wrong with you? So he's not the glass is half full. He's like, well, the glass is full. What are you talking about? You know, he is just, it's so irritating for somebody with a nice, you know, melancholic West of Ireland streak, you know. And I'm like, would you just bug off? You know, this is terrible. So anyway, Ricky gives me a call. He says, your name is on a sheet of paper in front of me. I have five names here. And it's to do some conducting at the Academy Awards. And my hands started shaking. And I don't know, still don't know why, because, you know, I love performing. But he told me the other names. And I just went, oh, there's not a chance here. There's not. One was an Oscar winner who I absolutely love and big fan of. And one was someone I knew was very, very politically connected. Very. As politically connected as you could possibly be. And I just said, well, it's nice being nominated, Ricky. It's nice. And he goes, I didn't put your name on the list, by the way. The producers already had it. And I said, oh, that's interesting. That's great. Well, you know, I've been around for a while. So anyway, I went away from that call and he said, just put your management in touch and, you know, I'll find out. I got some meetings coming up. We have a lot of other stuff going on. Might be a while. So I was absolutely felt sick. I thought, oh my God, oh my gosh, I felt really nervous. And I thought, this isn't me. What is this? You know? So then I thought to myself, I was driving back in the rain one day from leaving the kids at school and I thought, well, how would you feel if you're watching somebody else do it? I thought, oh, I don't know if I'd, I don't know how I feel about that. I thought, well, would you cop on then? I thought, oh yeah, yeah, it's just another concert, you know? So then I thought, don't invest. So I told Mom I was on the list and I said, whatever you do, don't tell the boys, don't tell my brothers, because I don't want to get emotionally invested in this because the odds are so stacked against me. It's ridiculous. Again, no connections, no nepotism, forget it. Ricky calls me one, and I was on tenterhooks. He calls me up and he goes, well, I've stayed up. I got up really early this morning and welcome to the Oscars 2020. I said, you're a rubbish actor. He's like, make, you know, sound like I hadn't gotten it. And I said, how did this come about? I said, I've never had nepotism. And he goes, well, neither did I. And that's the other thing about Los Angeles. There are plenty of people who've slogged their way up. And they love to see another slogger, you know,
it's
and
a
reach
wonderful
down.
Message to give
yeah,
out.
Reach down, yeah.
It really is.
And I said how, I later found out how I'd gotten on the list was a colleague, another colleague that I'd worked with years and years before. And just two guys, one is Austrian, the other's African-American. And the two producers were incredible. Stephanie Elaine, African-American grandmother who'd remortgaged her house to fund Hustle and Flow, her film. And Lynette Howell-Taylor from Liverpool.
Two women.
Yeah, she just finished nursing her youngest the week before the Oscars. All lunatics, you know, we're all the same lunatic streak. Stephanie Elaine came up to me afterwards. We were at the Governor's Ball. She put her arms around me and she said, I'm so proud of you. And we'd recorded back to back in Capitol Records because we record everything for safety. Everything you hear is live from the Oscars. It's all live. And an Irish girl had flown me there, Captain Elaine Egan. Oh. An Irish girl had dressed me, Claire Garvey. My aunt had bought my shoes. My other aunt had done my hair. My mom had come with me out to LA. Then the rest of them, the boys followed. I will tell you one last funny story is mum's cousin, Connie, saw a dress in, I think, Anthony Ryan's or somewhere in Galway and said, Mary has to have this dress. I don't know what it's for. So mom was with us backstage at the Oscars and the poor artist liaison couldn't keep tabs on mom. She was everywhere, you know, and all the dressing rooms and all the people backstage was great fun. So we're going out on the red carpet and I'm there with mom and with Craig and the girls on the entrance to the carpet say, you're only two of you can go. Well, your mom is not on the list for the carpet. And I just went, my first thought was, maybe I can let both of them go. And I was like, oh my God, this is horrifying. I looked at the two girls and went, oh, don't make me choose between my husband and my mother. And they looked at each other and they went, oh, go on.
Irish blood on yeah, them, definitely.
Definitely. Oh, go on is not really an LA thing, you know. No. And we just had such a laugh. It was just brilliant fun. Oh. And at the end of the show, mom goes to me, now I know who Brad Pitt is. And I said, what do you mean you know who Brad Pitt is? Well, I was the first person to congratulate him on getting his Oscar. And I was thinking, oh my God, was mum at the side of the stage? Was she in the wings? Where did she get to? And she said, no, I was in the winner's lounge. I was like, oh my God, you're not supposed to be in the winner's lounge. But there she was, you know. The Marys,
what a moment.
The Marys get
what a
everywhere.
Moment.
Does it get any better than that?
I don't know. I mean, it's this is the other thing is... if someone asked me when I was, I'm asking the same question I've been asked when I was conducting film music in Regent House in Trinity. If somebody asked me, if somebody said, do you think that one day you'll conduct John Williams for John Williams? The appropriate answer, the humble answer is, oh no, I couldn't imagine such a thing. But yes, I did imagine such
did.
A thing.
Mm-hmm. But
and
you
I
did.
Think that's the...
Dare to dream.
Dare to dream, the still small voice, you know. And it's... I think I said that I was doing some work with the Irish rugby teams, the ones that are going to the Olympics. And I said, I told them that story and I said, yes, I did think that. And I said, every single one of you in this room has seen yourself going to the Olympics. Mm. Don't pretend you haven't.
Mm. And that's what I see.
Proud of it.
Exactly. Exactly. Don't hide your light.
Exactly.
You know?
Is there anything you would change if you had the power to change something, whether it's in music, your life?
Gosh, that is a tough question. I mean, I get asked a lot from young composers, especially young women. And what would I change for them really is... What I say to them, what I say to Maddie, my stepdaughter who wants to be a theatre director, is see where you want to be. Assume you're going to get there and assume that's going to happen. But try and make the way there as wholesome and as happy and as beautiful as you can. Take the stress away from it, because don't stress about it, because you're going to get there anyway. Mm. If I had known that and made my journey less tortuous and less painful, I think that would be the one thing I would have changed about my own path. That's the thing I always say to the young women coming up behind me is, you will get there. Just put in the work, put in the time, hang in, be tenacious, but live your life. Enjoy the process. Enjoy every step, knowing that it's a step towards where you want to be.
Well, Emer, you're a wonderful ambassador for creativity and professionalism and support and women and the younger generation coming up.
Thanks a million.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you
both.
I've
really enjoyed this. I've just loved it.
Yeah, it's been great.
I've loved it.
What a woman is Emer Noon. Wouldn't you be proud as punch to think of her conducting the orchestra at the Oscars, and then to hear her say something as lovely as, well, LA is my city, but Galway is my home. She's an Irish woman to the core, and she's out there on the world stage.
I just feel like a whirlwind left the studio.
I know.
She is a whirlwind, and she's a gorgeous whirlwind.
Yeah.
You'd be so proud of her. Not just because she's multi-talented, but she's a multi-talented, lovely person. And she's a multi-talented, lovely person with this profound love of Ireland mm-hmm. that shaped her, that made her, but wasn't able to offer her the stage that she needed to be able to truly just outrageously blossom.
And she's so grounded, but she also has a huge resilience and a huge self-belief. And for her to take that court case and exactly. to feel so scared as she spoke to us and told us about the fears, and she did it for her own sake and also for the sake of the women coming after.
That's what really got me.
Yep.
The fact that this was not just about her winning for herself, but it was her pushing through a line that was holding other women back. But the wee girl from Ireland.
There you go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Every time. Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness.
Every
me.
Time.
Isn't it great? It
brilliant.
Really is. Make
utterly
you proud
brilliant.
As punch. Yes. Yeah. Emer yeah. Noon. And that brings us to the close of yet another episode of Changing Times. A heartfelt thanks goes out from us to our team working behind the scenes.
A very special shout out to our producer, Enda Grace, whose commitment makes this podcast a reality week after week.
And we must also thank our researcher, Anne-Marie Staunton, for her invaluable insights and tireless efforts that enrich these discussions.
And we can't forget to express our gratitude for Dundara Television and Media, which has become actually like a second home to us.
It certainly has. Don't forget to subscribe for more enlightening conversations on Changing Times.
From Alan Wood in beautiful County Kildare, farewell for now.
Changing Times, the Alan Wood Conversations.
Proudly supported by Kildare County Council.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.